I'd like to start with a reflection about why FFD is important. And as you may recall, 20 years ago, our government, Beijing, and I read the Beijing Declaration of Dialogue and Action. In this document, our government recognized the impact of globalization trends, structural adjustment programs, and privatization on women's human rights and lives. And they propose different measures and recommendations in order to revert these negative impacts. Also, they discuss additional way of funding gender equality, as well as reallocate the expenditures from the budget, including, for instance, to reduce excessive military expenditure. Also, governments agreed to ensure that all corporations, the private sector, comply with national laws and codes, social security regulations, and international conventions, including the ones related to environment. This kind of policies in this context now seems like so radical, and they were agreed by our governments in the middle of the Washington Consensus era. So, also, on Monday, our governments recognized that progress of the implementation of the Beijing Plan for Action has been slow and uneven. And the declaration recognized that major gaps remain and that obstacles, including structural barriers, persist in the implementation. However, the governments missed the opportunity to assess those gaps and to spell it out what are these structural barriers and, of course, promote measures to tackle them. And for our perspective, the financing for development process is key because some of these structural barriers for implementing the Beijing Platform for Actions are related with this agenda. Issues that range from financialization of the economy, the growing concentration of the economic power by corporate elites, the weakening of multilateralism, or the lack of political will to tackle global imbalance and implement development policies by human rights and inequalities are some examples of these structural barriers. Secondly, it's important because the debates on financing for gender equality commonly emphasize on women's financial inclusion, gender budgeting, or ODA for gender equality. However, the FFG agenda addresses in a very comprehensive way the quantity and the quality of different financing sources that can be allocated for gender equality and women's human rights. For instance, as some of our colleagues from Global Financial Integrity pointed out, for each dollar that entered to developing countries on ODA in 2012, over 10 US dollars came out as illicit financial flows. And moreover, the majority of these illicit financial flows, like 70% of it, are due to trade misinvoicing. So this is practices that multinational corporations are doing to invoice, to change the value of the commercial transaction and the invoice submitted to the customers. So we cannot only advocate for increasing ODA on gender equality without linking with the discussions on how to tackle the opacity of the global financial system that allows these practices to happen. And I would like also to address some of the key issues that we identified in the first Financing for Development drafting session in order to convince you of why it is important that we have a strong feminist movement following this agenda. And what we see in January, and also not in this FFD session, but as part of the global negotiations we were engaging, the core issue is how and who will pay the cost of the transition for a more sustainable and equitable development, and which reforms in the international economic and financial architecture would allow a change of this direction. So the first issue at stake is really whether to focus on private or public finance. The second issue is whether to focus on domestic action or international cooperation and systemic issues. Third refers in which extent FFD, as Rosa said, is linked with the means of implementation discussion under the post-2015 development agenda negotiations. to these challenges that are structural and that really are in absolutely all of the debates at the UN, and we have been facing in Monterrey, in Doha, and now again, a challenge is added, and it's related to what development means and which is the place gender equality and women's human rights are in these development models and alternatives. For instance, the first drafting session, the governments from different regions referred to gender equality and women empowerment. And I think never that I have never seen this before in the FFD process, like such a lot of people talking about gender, women, and so this is really important. And even a statement was released in the name of 20 countries, mostly from mostly developed countries. But 20 years after the Beijing Declaration, the challenge seems not just the visibilization of women in the development debates or in discourse, but how we can avoid an instrumental approach to women empowerment or women rights, and how we want to face the structural obstacles that limits the policy space to orient development strategies toward gender equality and women's rights. So regarding the first tension, we have been saying, and a lot of our colleagues in the Women's Working Group, that the emphasis on the private sector erodes state's responsibility in fulfilling women's rights and promoting development, sustainable development. The EU, United States, United Kingdom, Australia, Switzerland, among other developed countries, stressed that the promotion of the private sector in the FFD process is key. And the role of state should create an enabling environment for business to prosper. Also, the countries that submitted a joint statement on gender equality state that the private sector is an important partner in advancing gender equality and women's empowerment, since as employer, they advance family-friendly policies, equal pay, and opportunities for promotion. Within this framework of private sector engagement, foreign direct investment and public-private partnerships are promoted as the main finance mechanism. However, we have been highlighting that the links between private sector, jobs, gender equality, and sustainability are not automatic. It is necessary to resort to that data supporting these assumptions. For instance, from Latin America, we talk about the case of foreign direct investment. The greenfield investment, which is like really new projects on place, are only 60% of the inward of the foreign direct investment in the past decade. And it's also estimated that this investment accounts only for 50% of the net job creation. And if you, it is also another data that is really important. For every $1 million invested in foreign direct investment, only one job is created in extractive industries, while the same investment creates two jobs in natural resource intensive manufacturing. And these are two of the biggest sectors of foreign direct investment in our region. So this kind of assumption that FDI brings new employment and good for sustainable development, it's something that we need to challenge, to continue to challenge at the global level. Also, this research that was conducted by ECLAT says that there is no possibility to confirm any positive impact in terms of quality employment and the greater participation of women. So also, as another example of how this private sector engagement should be challenged is related to the prioritization of involvement of the private sector in providing services and infrastructure. And as many of you know, and also the Beijing Declaration states, the profit-driven nature of the private sector can threat the availability, accessibility, acceptability and quality of these services. I mean, Beijing didn't use this human rights language, but says that the negative impacts in terms of inequality. And we know this from our own experiences in our own regions. And this due by different facts, because provide services in rural, remote areas and informal settlements are not cost efficient. Secondly, because women are overrepresented in low-income households and are the more affected by increased tariff. And thirdly, because women absorb the adjustment by increasing the burden of home care work. So, and all the discussion of importance and central role of home care work in sustaining the economies should be really acknowledged. And regarding public-private partnerships, also in the session, a report of the OECD was quoted by several civil society organizations, but also by even the government. This report says that private participation in infrastructure can be complex, slow, and subject to frequent renegotiations and restructuring, which is bad for the public part of the partnership. And it's also recommend, this is an OECD, this is not from Latin America, says that if certain modalities has been a great failure in OECD countries, such as Spain and Portugal, this would be necessary to perform a careful analysis to establish if this could be successful in less developed countries, where cost of recovery is more difficult. So this is a question for the EU. Why they are promoting a financing modality that is not even working in many of their countries? Why they are promoting this as a solution for less developed countries? And for us, this is really important, especially our feminist organizations and colleagues working on sexual and reproductive rights, on education, on access to energy, because this is like a big push and we need to engage in those debates. And so we are saying that strong criteria for eligibility as well as dismissal of the private sector engagement should be put in place. And these accountability mechanisms also need to ensure that accessibility, affordability, and quality of service are there. So the second big tension was really in terms of the domestic versus the international. And we said that the emphasis on domestic issues is diluting, and also the new brand of universality is diluting the principle of international cooperation and common but differentiated responsibilities between countries in promoting sustainable development. In most of what we heard in the session, the developed countries focus on domestic resource mobilization, while developing countries strengthen the importance of implement ODA commitments, ensure additional funds for climate change, advanced technology transfer, as well as flexibilize intellectual property rules and democratize the economic governance, which are the key elements to then implement, of course, policies at the domestic level. Also, we alert governments about some of the recommendations of increase the need to expand the tax base, including the formalization of the informal sector. We have saying that from an equity and a human rights perspective, tax base should be increased in a progressive way, and also avoiding the gender bias of many of our tax codes. So also we acknowledge, and I think we partnered with the UN Women, emphasis on promoting gender responsive budgeting, but we are happy that governments in the session also strengthened their recommendations on the tax side of the fiscal policy, which are two sides of the coin. But as we said, it's really important that we look at what Monterrey talks about, the connection between the different levels of measures and policies that should take in place, not only at domestic but also at international level. And we are happy that governments in the joint statement referred to the language of CSW last year, which says that the government needs to work towards to ensure that the global trade, financial, and investment agreements are conducted to the promotion of gender equality and the empowerment of women and the human rights of women and girls. This is a very good recommendation. However, the government who promote this are the same governments that are not really to take steps forward the concrete recommendations that will allow this to happen. So some of these recommendations that we have been pushing for, it's to support the strengthening international tax corporations. Our government needs to shift from tax competition to attract foreign investment to a tax cooperation. And also, we need that this UN tax committee that we hope we can have a commitment on that at this conference, really include gender expertise in order to review national, regional, and global tax policy according to gender equality and human rights. Also, another proposal that was on the table, and for us is really important, is that this conference agreed an international legally binding instrument for transnational corporations in order also to honor Beijing recommendations, if we want. And this should be in alliance with and in compliance with what is being discussed under the Human Rights Council that you might be aware of. And thirdly, it's much more accountability should be put in place in order to hold the private sector accountable, not only at the national but also at the international level. So finally, the point of the need to have synergies between the financing for development process but the post-transition process, we raised that, but we said that the FFD agenda is more than the means of implementation of the post-2015 because it's covered a lot of issues and it also gives the policy framework to implement other agendas that are not reduced to the 17 goals that would be agreed, we hope. But also, not all the means of implementation of the post-2015 agenda can be decided at the Financing for Development Conference because include other issues such as capacity building or technology transfer that is not FFD the place to discuss it. So this idea of streamlining in order to be more efficient is and we know and we just experienced here in CSW how efficient argument is being used to dilute commitment in an advanced policy, progressive policy frameworks. So these are some of the message, and I'm sure that Tessa and our colleague from UN Women will further develop this.
Thank you, Nicole. Well, yeah, why don't we give a clap for Nicole? This is So Nicole left off around these tensions of the financing for development process and the post-2015. And our next speaker,